All right, everybody, thanks for joining me. We are doing bonus hours today, not the podcast, so this follows the format of the SiriusXM show. We're going to record 2 hours of shows, so we don't really do commercials. I say we're going to a commercial, but we just come right back and keep recording, and we're going to do 2 hours. So we take calls in order. The sooner you press 1 to get in line, the better your chances are of getting through and getting to ask your question. So whether you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything you want to add to the show, press 1 at any time. That puts you in the queue for questions. And if you press 1 right now, you've got a pretty good chance of getting through. The longer you wait, the odds are you may not make it. So let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, or anything else you want to talk about, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We are going to jump right into the phone calls tonight. Let's head off to Mississippi. Jason, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I got a couple questions for you. First thing is about air tabs. I pull a flatbed. If I put the air tabs on my truck, is that really going to help out that much?
You know, you may or may not see any kind of fuel mileage improvement. We know it's there. You know, in the beginning, we thought the air tabs on the tractor were just to address the gap between the tractor and the trailer, but they're really not. They would help on a truck that was bobtailing. They're helping that 90-degree angle at the back of the cab, so no matter what's behind it, the air tabs still create an aerodynamic improvement. Whether it's enough improvement to actually measure, sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, but we know it works. And I get so many good reports back. People like the stability that they feel. The rain spray tends to get knocked down in your mirrors. Your visibility's better. It's just one of those products that everybody seems to love. So, yeah, no matter what you have behind the tractor, putting air tabs on the tractor can make a difference.
Okay, sounds good to me. Next question I have for you is on alignment. I called MD Alignment to find out if there was a place near Memphis, Tennessee, that they would recommend. And they told me about a shop that was in West Memphis, so I called them, trying to set up an appointment with them, and I asked him about their alignment process, and I talked to one of their techs. He told me their process was to go ahead and jack it up, put it on the plates, and use the laser alignment system. I was like, I don't think that's what I'm looking for.
Right, you're not. You are correct. Here's the thing. MD Alignment builds equipment, alignment equipment, and they do training. So, you know, Mike Beckett will go out and set up a shop as an MD Alignment shop. He goes in, gives them the equipment, does all the training, everybody's good. The minute you walk out of that building, things can start changing. And then what happens over time is you get a new service manager in, you get a couple new techs in, and within a year, there might not be anybody in the shop who remembers that training. And they could be on to something totally different. Now, Mike does a pretty good job of trying to follow up with these shops, make sure they still have the equipment, make sure they still understand the training. But a lot of the shops fall through the cracks. So you did the right thing. Rather than just assuming that they're a true MD Alignment shop, you called and asked, I would stay away from there. I mean, I would find somebody else.
Okay. I generally stay within about 300 miles of Memphis. Would Mike know of any place that I might be able to take
you
to?
Always. Yeah, you can always call them. I mean, they'll certainly help you out. You may end up driving a little farther to get it done, but I can tell you it's worth it because here's the problem with alignments. There are two ways that we know a truck has an alignment problem. The first one is handling. if it's not doing something right when we drive it, if it's pulling too hard to the right, if it wanders around on the road and follows all the grooves, those are all indications that we have an alignment problem. But there are times when we have alignment problems you can't feel. They don't affect handling at all. The other way we know we have an alignment problem is tire wear. But by the time the tire is worn enough that you can see it, it's too late to save it. So the problem with bad alignments is you might get an alignment done, and if you drive out and there are no handling issues and you assume it's right, it's going to be several months before you realize it's wrong. So in my opinion, it's worth it to find a good shop. Like, I know this might sound a little crazy, but you're not all that far from Kansas City.
I was thinking the same thing, trying to get a hold of Chad.
Yeah, I would run up to Kansas City and let Chad do it.
I believe that's what I'm going to do. So you got time for one more quick question?
Sure, go ahead.
I've been listening to you for a few months now, and I haven't heard you touch on the subject of tire balancing and what kind of method you prefer for that.
Okay, actually, I talk about it pretty extensively. So, but you're right, I haven't in a while. I had the privilege of spending time at Michelin's Proving Grounds. And we've got a great relationship with Michelin, so they put me through their garage. I got to spend time with their engineers. I got to drive trucks on the test track. And I got to see how they recommend mounting a tire. Now, you're talking about balancing, but balancing starts long before we ever choose how to balance a tire. Now, what Michelin actually recommended was they walked us through the process. They put the rim up on the rim alone, up on the truck, mounted, and they check that rim for radial runout. So you put a runout gauge against the rim. You check to make sure the rim isn't bent. Now, steel rims can be horribly bent and way out of spec. Aluminum rims, almost never. It happens. So that's the first step. Then you mount the tire, and they showed us all the proper procedures for mounting a tire. And it's surprising how many shops do it wrong. And then after the tire gets mounted, there's a simple check. There's what's called a beauty ring or an alignment ring. It's right down close to where the tire meets the rim itself, and it's a ridge on the tire. So what you do is you measure that ridge in four places, like top, bottom, left, and right. And it should be within a 32nd of an inch. So the distance should not vary. And if it does, you need to remount that tire. So once we get the tire mounted right, then we put it back on the truck again, put the runout gauge on it, and what we're looking for is less than 60 thousandths of an inch difference when we roll that tire with the runout gauge against it. Now, according to Michelin, if you've got a good tire and you follow all those procedures and you're under 60 thousandths on runout, you don't need to balance the tire. I agree with everything up until that point, because if you do all those steps, you are going to have a good tire mount and the balance should be good. But I like to put counteract balance beads in the tire when I mount it. They're dynamic balancers so that over the life of the tire, things can change. We can even just pick up a little bit of mud in the back of a rim, and that can throw an assembly way out of balance. And having a dynamic balancer like Counteract can make up for that. So my process is follow all those steps. I even go one more when I can. If I can find a shop that can true a tire, I always true my steer tires. What that actually does, they actually put it on a machine that cuts it, and it takes a little bit of tread off the high spots and gives you a perfectly round tire. Now, I've gotten it down to where I've had tires under 10 thousandths. I've gotten them, you know, much, much closer to tolerance by truing. So I follow all the procedures Michelin recommended. I true the tire if I can. Put in the counteract, and now you've got a balanced tire, wheel, and assembly.
Now, does the Centromatic, do they work like the balancing beads?
They do. And I've used Centromatics for years. I've used Balance Masters for years. Same thing. same idea, slightly different products. And several years ago when we were building all the signature trucks and I was in the shop testing things all the time, we started using the Counteract and comparing it. And what we found was the Counteract worked much better in wide singles. And I think the reason is the dynamic balancers like Centromatic sit on the inside of a wide single, and the Counteract spreads across the whole tire. And I think the wide singles can be, it's such a big tire that I think sometimes, not always because I've used them and they've worked fine, but sometimes the dynamic balancers like Centromatics or Balance Masters don't do as well on the wide singles. So that was why we switched, because Counteract just seems to work for me every time.
Okay. Having the tires truth, is that something that is easy to find a shop to do?
No, actually it's not. I had never really seen it until I started working with, of all places, Fleet Air Filters. Fleet Air Filters, the owner also owns a big RV repair shop, truing on, you know, lots and lots of RV tires. And that was the first time I saw it, saw the machine, and I've been trying to use it ever since. But I don't find many shops that have it. So you got to look. If you can find it, great. If not, you're still okay. If you can get that tire under 60 thousandths and then use Counteract, it'll be as smooth as you can imagine. You'll get better tire wear, and it does increase fuel economy as well. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog Sirius, XM 128. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website, letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's go to Oklahoma. Scott, welcome to the program.
Howdy, Kevin. My truck's been averaging over 7 miles to the gallon for the last month or so.
Wow.
I filled up a few hours ago, about had a coronary. I'm down to under six. I'm down to about 5.4.
Uh-oh.
But what I've noticed is for the last couple of weeks, my speedometer all of a sudden will drop down to about 15 miles an hour and stay there for any given length of time. What I have to do is shut the engine off, turn it back on. Sometimes that'll trip it and it'll go back up. Other times I just have to wait till it feels like it. And I took the number of gallons, multiplied it by six, and I came up that I'm 51 miles different from what the speedometer is showing, and to be getting the bare minimum at six, showing, you know, 51 miles different. So any recommendations what I should look for? Because this speedometer has only got about 60,000 miles on it.
So what we're saying is the fuel mileage really wasn't correct, because when the speedometer drops to 15 miles an hour, your odometer is only registering that as well, correct? So we're saying your odometer is reading incorrectly.
Right. I timed it about 60 miles an hour is a mile a minute, so every tenth is 6 seconds, and
right.
Taking longer than that.
Yeah, and I just want to verify that the odometer is wrong as well as the speedometer, and it probably is. So there are several options here, and it really depends on how much money you want to spend. When you say the speedometer is new or fairly new, is that the physical speedometer in the dash itself, and did they replace anything else, like the speed sensor on the transmission or anything else?
No, they had a used speedometer that had 10,000 miles less than the one that was in there because the other one was doing the same thing, and we replaced
probably,
it, and this one was good until about 2 months ago.
Probably wasn't the speedometer then. It's probably the speed sensor back on the transmission. And again, there are a couple things you can do here. If you just want to fix it, that's where I would start. If it's not that big of a deal and you don't want to spend the money right now, I would either go by, you know, GPS miles if you run a GPS, or you could throw a cheap hubometer on it for a while if it's just fuel mileage you're trying to track and you're not too concerned about the speedometer. Or like I say, if you want to fix it, I would start with the speed sensor.
Okay, because for the most part, I run right on the edge of about 1,400 RPM at any given time, which to me is about 58 miles an hour.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point that, you know, when money gets a little tight, there are some repairs that we can put off. I mean, having a speedometer is really not all that critical. I mean, you've been driving your truck long enough, you know how fast you're going in any given gear, close enough that you're not going to get a ticket. And then, like I say, if it's fuel economy, and measuring fuel economy is important, but, you know, you can bolt a hubometer on there in 10 minutes and have, you know, accurate readings, or if you're using a GPS, you can use that.
Well, I don't have a GPS. I'm still sort of old school with things, but I'm getting dragged into the new century a little bit at a time. But,
well, you know, my GPS has a speedometer right on it that's more accurate than the one in my truck, so I use it.
Okay, that's cool.
Your scan gauge. Well, you know what? If your speed sensor is wrong, your scan gauge may end up being wrong too.
I don't have a scan gauge as yet. It's a little right now. It's a little. We're still in. Coming out of survival mode, but we're still in it.
Yeah, and that's why I say I think your cheapest fix to make sure that you've got, you know, accurate hubometer or odometer readings to do your fuel mileage, which is important. Having the speedometer, it's just not that important to me. I can do without one. Knowing my miles, though, is important to track fuel mileage. So your cheapest fix is just going to be to bolt a hubometer on it and be done with it for now.
Okay, let's probably do that for the time being. It doesn't do it all the time, but when it does it, it's always seems like on real rough roads. And
and when it does it, it's wiped out your ability to track that whole tank. So your numbers will always be off. So even though it's not doing it very often, like I say, the hubometer will fix it for now. You'll have your numbers and you'll be good. Let's go to Kentucky. Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, tax season has brought a question to my mind that I was hoping you could help me on. I understand how to calculate per diem and meal expenses when you're away from home. What option do I have on keeping track of everything when I'm not away for the night? I may still work 14 hours a day, but because of my routing, I'm home a lot more often, even though that may just consist of being able to sleep in my own bed and getting a shower at home. I'm still using and spending just about as much money on meals, even though I'm not staying out all night. So I don't really qualify for the necessarily away from home, so do I just have to keep track of every receipt at this point?
No, actually, you don't get a deduction, period. So
really?
The good news is it's easy. You don't have to do anything. The bad news is you don't get a deduction. Yeah, let's say you leave even at 4 o'clock in the morning and you go work, 14, 15, 16 hours local, and you come back home after working even 16 hours, you came back home, no per diem.
Wow. Okay.
The only way you qualify for per diem is to stay away from home. That's the only time you qualify for per diem. So the allowance or real receipts, none of that matters because you don't qualify for any per diem to start with on those days.
Okay. All right, well, simple enough. Like you said, good news, bad news.
Yeah, yeah, it's easy. It's just not the news you wanted to hear. Let's go to Washington. David, welcome to the program.
So good evening, Kevin. I just wanted to kind of put my two cents in. I talked to you before back in 06 and 09. I don't know if you remember. I've got this 1991 T600 that I've been driving since, and I've got over 3 million miles on it.
Wow.
And in 06, my engine went out, and basically because I was stupid and I wasn't real clear about your antifreeze and that kind of stuff. So electrolysis took the engine out. You know, it was my fault. And so anyhow, I kind of retired the truck. I went out. I had to have another truck, so I bought an International 9200 in 03. Well, in 09, the wind blew that over in California. So I said, well, I don't know what car was going to do at the time. So I said, well, I got this old 91, so I went and bought a Z-Deck 4, 500 horse, put in here. And my plan was to put it in for 1 year and then go buy another truck. Because when I bought it from a recycling place, and I'm pretty good friends with them. So for $3,500, I bought this engine. I was going to bring it home, rebuild it. It had like 850,000 on it. So we pulled the bearings. They were really good shape, like perfect. So I did a full oil sample. It came out perfect. I said, well, screw it. Let's put it in. I'm only going to run it for a year. So we just put it in. You know, the labor cost me very little because I did most of it myself. We put it in. Well, I changed the bolt gears. I did that. It was chattering a little bit. And I put a new water pump on it, and I'm still driving it. I've done nothing else to this engine since then, except I've got a couple overheads on it. And, you know, that's pretty much, you know, I've got over 3 million miles on this. The engine's got like 1.5 on it. And so what I'm going to be doing now, since I can't go into California anymore with this truck after July 1st, I'm opening up a truck driving school over in Tangent, Oregon. I think I talked to you about it. So that's what I'm going to use this old truck for, and I think it would be really good. It's got the 13-speed. And oh, when I put it on the road, I did change. I put a set of rear ends and another transmission in. Then I got the really cheap price. So mechanically, you know, I do most of the work myself, and this thing's been good. I mean, my maintenance is – I spend about – maybe $8,000 a year is all I spend on this truck, and most of that is tires.
Which is just outstanding. You know, I love stories like this. On the other hand, I had two emails today, people telling me horror stories about their new $140,000 trucks that they can't keep on the road for a week at a time. Get them out of the shop on Friday, they're back in the shop on Monday. Fuel mileage is horrible. I don't know what more to say about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Truckin',
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. We're going to get back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Oregon this time. Martin, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
I have a rig dig report I'd like to go over with you and some specs on a truck I'm looking at.
All right. So I've got the rig dig report here. It looks like we've got an 01 Volvo with the 60 Series Detroit, one of my favorite trucks. And the rig dig looks pretty darn good. Nothing major. Inspections. Now, remember, this is an 01. It's been on the road a long time. It has had 21 total violations and 5 out of service. I looked at them. They're almost all brakes. So somebody didn't know how to adjust brakes very well. Other than that, I don't really see anything. And the carriers that have owned this truck don't have any negative CSA ratings. So for an 01, this is a really good-looking rig dig. This would not worry me at all.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Most of, or a lot of them were logbook violations, too, I noticed.
Yeah, you know, when we see 21 total violations, that doesn't tell us if it's truck or driver. When I scrolled through, most of them were driver. You know, it had full inspections where it wasn't getting it had been inspected a lot. And nothing in here jumps out to say, you know, that it's a truck that wasn't taken care of.
Well, I've just finished looking at it. I haven't found a reason yet not to buy it. I found some negotiating points. It's got a few oil leaks. He's asking $15,000 negotiable for it. It's got a on the clock, it's got over 1 million miles on it, 1.231. But it had a crate motor put in it at Pacific Detroit at 150,000 miles ago.
Oh, wow.
So the engine.
That's
the engine's
a plus.
Yeah. It's had the front drive rebuilt. It's got a Weller reman in it, done recently. It has a rear main seal leaking and some other oil leaks, but he's willing to negotiate, and I figured it looked like a reasonable buy.
Oh, this is a find. These are the kind of trucks, you know, $15,000, he's willing to negotiate, get it for $13,500, $14,000, even at $15,000. I mean, we always want to negotiate, and he's already said he's willing, so you know you're not going to pay $15,000, but even at $15,000.
Right.
With the new crate motor, how can you go wrong? The engine's worth
well,
that.
That's, yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, it's got some cosmetic stuff that we'll need doing, but that doesn't stop you making money with it.
Yeah, you know,
okay.
the benefit here is you could just keep this truck the way it is and make a bunch of money with it, and worst-case scenario, you'd have great components to build a glider if you wanted to, but so you really can't go wrong. I mean, most of the time when we see these trucks for $15,000, they've got 1.2 million miles on them and they haven't been touched yet. And I'm still willing to pay $15,000 for them. You're getting one with a new crate engine.
Okay, that's kind of where I was. They sent an oil sample out for me, but they sent it to CAT, but that's better than nothing. And they're going to download the ECM for me. I'll shoot that information over to you when I get it back and maybe we can get back together and discuss that, but I don't see any reason yet not to buy this.
No, I'm not seeing any. And CAT actually does a good job on their oil samples. The only thing that they tend to lack is they have a hard time picking a fuel dilution, but we can usually tell in the viscosity anyway. So that'll be a good sample when it gets back. I'd be more than happy to go over it with you.
Okay, well, that was all the questions I had, but I can't, like I said, it seems like a go to me. It'd get me out of my 2013 headache.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think you're absolutely on the right track here. I don't see any reason so far not to buy this, and I'm not sure that we're going to find a reason. I keep looking, get the ECM, get the oil sample. The more information we have, the better. But I'm not really thinking of anything that would cause me not to buy this one. I think this is a find. Let's go to Alabama. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good. What can I help you with?
Hey, I've got a question, actually a couple questions about a truck and one question about your profit gauges, fuel gauges. Now, I'll start off with a profit gauges question. I'm getting ready to buy this truck, and my carrier does not show me the discount that we get at Pilot Swan J. We don't know. It's different at each one, you know. Is there
Uh-oh. Matt? Matt, I think we're losing you. I'm going to put you on hold, and I think I can answer. Well, I was going to answer your question, but you dropped. So we'll try to get you back. Let's go to Connecticut. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
I've had some people calling the show for the truck so that you don't idle. And I was wondering if what kind of ACs those are, AC units those are. Are they really noisy, and do you just need like a pure sine inverter just to configure them?
You know, we've talked about lots of different configurations. I don't have one that I'm just absolutely in love yet. I'm still doing the research. I'm still talking to people. I'm still getting feedback. But basically what we've been talking about primarily is having an inexpensive generator, not an APU, something like a Honda or a Yamaha portable generator. They're actually very, very quiet. That's one advantage to them is they're quiet. Using that to, you know, having some deep cycle batteries along with it, maybe even a totally extra set of deep cycle batteries, and a sine wave inverter, a pure sine wave inverter, and then running an RV-style air conditioner, a rooftop,
right,
back wall units. Some people are buying cheap, room air conditioners and just venting them out the window. So,
right. I was wondering about those inexpensive ones where I know they're not going to last over 3 months, but they'll, you know, 3-4 months, and you probably get another one. Because what you're talking about is fairly elaborate, and it's going to cost a lot of money, and I don't want to spend that kind of money right now. But I was wondering if I could be a room conditioner. I mean, you just connect it directly to an inverter, and you're done, and when it clocks out, you just go get another one?
Well, there are a couple things you have to make sure of. The air conditioners are notoriously hard to get started, meaning when they first come on and you got to get that compressor moving, they draw lots and lots of power. So you have to make sure that your inverter has that kind of startup amperage to get them going. So that's the one thing you do have to make sure is that either your generator or your inverter. And honestly, I just don't think if you don't know what you're doing as far as matching components, batteries, amp hours, the odds of successfully running air conditioners off of batteries, I think many people are going to be disappointed. I mean, I don't think we're quite there yet. It can be done. But what I've been saying is there's no inexpensive system put together. People are cobbling together their own pieces and parts, and when you do that, you're going to get different results every time. And that's why I've been trying to build a system so that I could say, if you have these batteries, this generator, this inverter, and this air conditioner, here's how it will perform. That's the project that I'm trying to complete. I'm not done yet. So other than having that, like I say, depending on which components you try to put together, you're going to end up with totally different results.
Yeah, I was just trying to find a simple solution that would fairly cool my cab if I end up in some really hot environment for the most part.
Right.
Nothing too expensive.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm just not done yet. I do know lots of people, like I say, that have put together their own, and results are kind of all over the board. I want to put together a system, like I say, that I could say, here it is and here's how it will perform. Just not done yet. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. You can also find us on Facebook.com. Search for my name, search for Let's Truck, and follow us there as well. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. All right, a quick word before we start this segment. This is the fourth segment of the show, the final segment. So at the end of this, I'm going to say I'm done, I'm out of here, Jonesy's up next. All that stuff I say at the end of a show. Don't hang up because we'll come right back and start recording another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. I'm going to head off to Connecticut. Mike, welcome. Ooh, no, hold on. We just did. Mike, we're going to go to California. Kenneth, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing great. What can I help you with?
Aerodynamics. I bought a 2010 International Pro Star that was set up for a reefer application. It's a mid-roof with a whale's tail on top. And now I'm using the truck as a tanker operation. Because
yank that whale tail off and throw it in the ditch.
I have already taken it off, but
good.
The little bitty aluminum brackets that hold that thing on are still on because they were pop riveted in the top of the roof. And I didn't want to take those off and create holes inside that sleeper area. Are those little brackets still going to create a lot of aerodynamic problems for me?
I would try to get them as flush to the top as possible. I'm with you. I wouldn't take them off. I wouldn't drill out the rivets because you are going to end up with leaks, or you're going to have to work really hard to close it all back up. But if I could, I would cut those brackets as flush as possible with the surface.
All right. The side skirts and the fairings on the side have also been taken off because of the weight restriction. I have the loads I pick up with the drive axles right at 34,000, and so I took those off to try to lower the weight. Because of fuel mileage, should I put them back on and say screw it and just live with the weight problem?
This is one of those things that we might be able to put some numbers to. If you put them back on, are there loads you're going to have to turn down, or will there be loads that you will take on less payload and therefore make less money?
Good question. I can't answer that one. I would basically tell the customer I can't take it, and they would have to take product off, or I can figure out a way to go around the scales. How's that?
Okay, either one of those is fine, and as long as it doesn't interfere with the revenue, then I would put them back on. As long as it doesn't interfere with your revenue, meaning if you're going to start making less money, then we need to look at this. And I can tell you that having the fairings on the truck, the side fairings, will save you roughly $2,500 a year in fuel cost. So now you could look at that and say, am I going to lose more than $2,500 in revenue somewhere? Because if you are, then don't put them back on.
I understand what you're saying. The deal was tankers don't give you very much aerodynamic anyway. Would the fairings make any difference, in a tanker application?
Here's the thing to remember about aerodynamics. For the most part, forget what the trailer's doing. And even forget, does everything work together? I mean, we'd love to have everything working together. But any time we make an aerodynamic improvement, we will see the results. And the results on side fairings are roughly 2 to 3 tenths of a mile per gallon, which works out to about $2,500 a year. So if you put them on, you'll save $2,500 a year in fuel. I just want to make sure you're not going to lose that $2,500 in revenue somewhere.
Oh, that's a good question. I can't answer that one because that situation hasn't come up yet. But I will put those fairings back on.
Yeah, put them back on and then keep an eye on it. And, you know, if it starts affecting your revenue, meaning you've got to take product off and then that pays less, or you've got to turn down loads, then you have to go back and look at it and say, which one makes more sense? Am I losing so much revenue that I just need to take those things back off? Fuel mileage is important, but remember, the goal of getting better fuel mileage isn't just to get better fuel mileage. It's to improve the bottom line. So if we do something that improves our fuel mileage but hurts our revenue, that doesn't make any sense. We have to look at the whole picture. Let's go to Nebraska. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I know you're good. I'm good.
Good. What's up?
I got two questions for you. One, my drives. I can't control trailer tires, but I control my tractor tires. I got XZA 3 Plus on the front, 2 on the drives, and I know those are horrible for rolling resistance. What kind of mileage increase could I expect by putting a X1 Line Energy D on?
Did you say a T trailer?
No, a D, X Line Energy D.
D for drive, and you're coming off the XDN2s, correct?
Correct.
Right around 4 tenths is what you'll pick up.
About 4 tenths. Awesome, awesome. And I had a question about my steer tire weight. I've got a 14,000-pound axle. I have to run with the fifth wheel all the way back to be able to scale on these 14-ply tires. So I wanted to go up to the 16, but I run a coast-to-coast operation, so I didn't know what issue I would have with scales running 14 on steers.
You know, here's the thing. They've argued this back and forth over the years. There have been a couple states that tried to limit steer axle weight, but technically a single axle is capable of hauling 20,000 pounds as long as you have all the right components, meaning the axle is capable of it, the wheels, the tires. So the limit on your steer axle is either 20,000 pounds or what your equipment is capable of handling, and that's federal. And the states can't really override that. A couple of them tried issuing tickets at times, but I think for the most part they got beat in court, and I'm not going to say somebody isn't writing tickets for that somewhere, but I don't hear much about it anymore. The way I understand it is that you are legal on that axle as long as your components are all legal for whatever weight you're scaling on it.
Okay, so being that it is a 14,000-pound rated axle and I put the 16-ply tire on, I should be good.
Exactly. Yep, just make sure you check the weight rating on the tire and make sure that all of your components are capable of handling the weight you've got on there, and then you'll be fine.
Awesome. So if I do all them changes, I should be able to get up to 7 because I'm sitting at 6.5 now.
Yep, that should put you there.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. In fact, that's the concept I'm looking at, building a heavier axle up to maybe even 15,000 pounds. And going with a single-axle tractor and a spread-axle trailer. I mean, I think that is my next signature project is going to be a truck and trailer combination. Let's go to Texas. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing tonight?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I'm looking at buying my first truck, first time trying to be an owner-operator. And I think I might have found my truck. However, I'm still going to go out tomorrow and look at a couple more because I don't want to pick the first one I think I found. But this one here seems really good from what I've seen. I'm going to go up and actually see it in person out in Dallas, Texas tomorrow. I have a rig dig report sent out, and I also have the specs, and I just kind of wanted to see what you thought about it and what you might think that I possibly might get in fuel economy, because that's kind of one of the most important aspects.
All right. So my first question is, do you have to be California compliant?
No, I don't. However, the carrier I'm running with, they require 1,000 or 7 or newer truck, and that's the reason why I'm looking at a 2008.
Okay. Do you realize that there's a huge difference between 08 and 07, and if I had to, I would buy an 07?
Okay.
Because you don't have a DPF to deal with.
Okay.
The 08s all have DPF. And DPF added a whole new layer of problems.
Okay.
So if it were me, especially first truck, I'm not a fan. I've got to tell you, I'm not a fan of first trucks, you know, and I understand carrier rules. I wish they would get rid of those rules. I've been fighting that in this industry for years. I'm not a fan of buying one of these trucks as your first. It's a huge risk. I mean, I was just talking about it. We heard the guy with the 91 that's got 3 million miles on it, and he only spends $8,000 a year on maintenance. I don't know anybody with an 08 that only spends $8,000 a year on maintenance. Sometimes you roll in the shop and they charge you $8,000 just to look at these trucks, I swear. So I would encourage you to go back and look for a cheaper 07 instead. I just think that you need to minimize that startup risk. I would even talk to your carrier about seeing if they'll make an exception and keep being able to buy an older truck. I would have a hard time recommending this truck to you as a first-time truck. I think you could do better. Stick around. Jonesy's up next with the all-night truck stop. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here. You're on the road to Sirius XM 128. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, getting your own authority, whatever it is, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We are going to go right to the phone calls. I'm gonna bring on somebody from last night's show because I kind of got rushed at the end there. I was talking to somebody about their first-time truck, and I want to be able to finish up on that conversation. So I'm going to head to Texas. Tim, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so on last night's show, we had to rush a little bit there at the end, and I didn't feel like I did a good enough job explaining. What's the price on this 08?
They want $45,000.
Okay, so just to catch everybody up, you're looking at an 08. It's your first truck. Your carrier, you don't really have to be California compliant, but your carrier requires an 07 or newer. My point to you is that there's a huge difference between 07 and 08. That was the technology break where the 08s, for the most part, all the 08s are going to have a DPF and the 07s aren't. Now, there was a time when I thought moving to the DPF was going to be a good thing because we reduced the amount of EGR. But it doesn't seem to be solving any of the EGR problems, and it's added a whole bunch of new problems, which is the regens and the DPF cleaning, and these trucks are expensive to maintain. I think you can find an 07 in the $30,000 range, because what happened with the 08s is the prices went up on them because it requires an 08 to be California compliant. So the prices went up on all the 08s and down on all the 07s. So you okay. will find a much, much bargain if you look for an 07 instead.
Okay. If I find an 07, from listening to you in the past, you know, looking at specs, obviously I'm not going to find the pre-emission 12.7 with the year I have to purchase. I'm looking at my idea is looking at about a 355 gear ratio for a 13-speed with roughly a 450 ISX.
Yeah, that'll work. ISX isn't my favorite engine, but when you're looking at certain trucks, you're going to be pretty limited. If you want PACCAR products, you know, you can't get a Series 60 or a DD15 or any of those. So if you like the ISX and you're okay with it, just know that they can have some issues. Take care of the top end, do oil samples, that kind of stuff. But the rest of your specs, you're on the right track. If you get 355s and a 13-speed, you're going to be just fine. I would even go back to your carrier, and I would put together a good presentation showing them why you want to buy an 03 and see if they'll go for it. They might just make an exception. Let's go to Texas. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. On a Sunday's show towards the end, a guy was calling in talking about lithium batteries, and he kind of dropped out before you to the subject matter of his question or whatever. But it appeared to me that you had talked to him in the past and knew him. And I was wondering if you knew where he got that lithium battery or any information, how much he paid for it or any information.
Oh, I did talk to him once before, and he did send me a link on where he was getting these batteries built. I'm going to have to go find it, though, is the problem. I'm probably not going to be able to find it while I'm talking. He was actually working with a company that was going to build him one big lithium-ion battery that would replace four Group 31 batteries. Now, I don't remember on the first call if he told me the price or not, but I'm thinking, based on what I know about lithium-ion, that the price on that battery has got to be somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000. It's not going to be cheap.
Yeah, that's about what I've been finding, around $4,000. I did find a guy that would build a 13 by 13 cube that, you know, was had tremendously more capacity, but he wanted 13.5 for it.
Yeah, that's a little crazy. I think that right now, with what we know, lithium ion is the next technology to move to for batteries. Hopefully something else comes along, because lithium ion still has some problems. And right now, the biggest problem is just the cost. I mean, that is coming down every year. And, you know, if I could replace all four batteries for $4,000, and I think he told me they were giving him a 5 or 6 year full replacement warranty. They said this thing would last through lots and lots of cycles. You still can't really claim that it's cost effective. It's just not. You would be cheaper and better off to just keep replacing, you know, good AGM batteries every couple years. But if we get down around 4,000, that's kind of the entry point that we could start experimenting with. Some people could anyway. I mean, there are some people that would never even think about spending that much, but there are others, I think, where if we start to get that price down, we'll see more people experimenting and we'll learn more about it. Actually, Matt just sent me a text message. He said the company claimed they gave him a 10-year warranty. Now, with a 10-year warranty, we could start to make an argument that this is coming to the point where it might become cost effective soon.
Most of the ones that I've looked at have claimed a 10-year battery life. They don't claim a 10-year warranty, but they claim 10-year battery life.
Yeah, what I'm interested in, and we do know lithium ion stands up much better to charge and discharge, which is what we need. What I'm interested in is how well will they hold up on from the punishment of the road. See, I don't think we have a lot of data on that yet.
Yeah, that would be my concern.
You know, yeah, you've got the pounding of the road, you've got extreme temperature changes, you've got a lot of unusual conditions for a battery, and I'm not totally convinced yet that the lithium ion are going to stand up to it. And the only way we're going to know is if we start experimenting, but the price has to get to a point where experimenting makes sense, and we're getting closer.
Well, the lithium polymer, I think, would stand up more to the vibration and the bouncing than the lithium ion. And it has the same capacity, but I'm not polymer in big batteries. I'm just finding
lithium
ion.
Yeah, I'm not either. Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. The lithium ion's pretty rare, but we're starting to see it become more common. I haven't seen lithium polymer at all.
Yeah, not in the big batteries. I mean, there's some companies
right.
that make custom-made power cells that use lithium polymer, but again, they're pricey. You know,
right.
They cost more than your house sometimes.
Yeah, we're not quite ready for that. So I'm going to have to go look for that information, and I'll try to put it up on Facebook when I find it. I know he sent it to me, and I've got it on a list of things I want to follow up on. Just don't remember where I put it. Let's go to Missouri. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got a question about taxes. I've depreciated my truck out, and now I got to start paying some real money in taxes. And I've looked into, you know, I think I want to create an LLC that's taxed like a C corp, so I can pay myself dividends. Now, my question
you mean
is,
an S corp?
Yes, I'm sorry, an S corp. Yes.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
My question is about how to optimize my per diem, because the way it looks to me is like I've never paid myself payroll taxes, so I don't know exactly how that works. But it seems like if I took per diem on the as a company driver, I'd still end up paying 7% on payroll that I couldn't take off as a deduction. Now, like as a private contractor, just a sole proprietor, you know, your per diem comes off your total gross revenue, so it saves you your income tax and in your Social Security tax. Do you see what
well,
I'm trying
with
to
the
say?
S-corp, the S-corp is going to save you the same thing because what happens is you're going to do this on payroll, and on payroll what's going to happen is that you will receive that money tax-free, and that's completely tax-free, meaning not only do you not pay income tax on it, but you also don't pay your half of the Social Security, and neither does the employer. They don't have
okay.
to pay their half of the Social Security either. So you are still
okay.
getting that same benefit that you would when you do it as a sole proprietor. Having said that, I've got to come back and give you one other rule that you should just be aware of. And I'm
okay.
going to do that right after the break, so stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog Sirius, XM128. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
I believe that
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to go back to Missouri. Adrian, you still with me? So there are still many ways we can take advantage of per diem as a sole proprietor. In fact, we can create a couple advantages. Here's the issue that I have. And I just tell you this just for full disclosure. I've read the rules about per diem and S-corps, and you're not supposed to be able to do it. The IRS rules, if you dig deep enough, say that if you own more than 2% of a corporation, which obviously you do, then you can't use per diem, period. You actually have to use true meal receipts and expenses. Now, that's what the rules say. But I found that rule 16 years ago, and I pointed it out to a bunch of other tax preparers, and I asked everybody, and everybody said the same thing. Wow. We never knew that was there. We've always taken per diem for our S-Corp clients. Nothing has ever happened. And I believe them. I know lots of firms that have done this for literally hundreds, even thousands of S-Corps using the per diem. I don't even think the IRS knows that they have that rule. But I anytime somebody asks me, I just like to put it out there. So, you know, full disclosure. The way I read the rules, you can't use per diem as an S-Corp, but everybody does, and they have been for years.
Okay. So that was kind of my predicament there is, like, if you pay yourself per diem, does that count towards, like, money that the IRS would look at as a salary? Because I know you got to pay yourself a reasonable salary.
Reasonable salary. Yes, they would, and here's why. Because
okay,
we
cool.
we can make a direct comparison to company drivers in the industry. We can point at hundreds or thousands of other trucking companies and say, the guy made $45,000 for the year, but he got $30,000 of it as wages and $15,000 as per diem. I mean, that's the standard in the industry. So if you do
right.
the same thing, pay yourself $45,000, $30,000 of it is, you know, wages and $15,000 is per diem, we're just doing what everybody else does.
So aren't you a little bit ahead, too, because can't you pay yourself the full $59 a day and not have to take that 80%?
Yeah, you can take the $59 a day tax-free. Your corporation is only going to be able to deduct 80% of what they paid you in per diem.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. But it still works. I mean, you get tax-free
sure. no,
money,
you don't
your
lose
corporation.
Anything. You don't lose
right.
anything at all. And that's what I wanted to make sure. Like, if I was wondering about just not paying myself per diem from my company and just taking my per diem on my the company's side of my taxes. And I would still
no, you're,
you understand that would
yeah.
I would be missing out on half my Social
exactly.
Security tax savings
right.
if I did it
no,
that way.
You want your corporation to pay you in per diem.
Right. Okay. I didn't quite know how that would work, if that would work out, and seems like that's the way I'll do it.
There you go. Yep, that'll do it. Let's go to Texas. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. I got into an accident last week, and I'm looking to replace my truck.
Okay.
After listening to you over the years, the first thing I did is just started looking for a Volvo 2001 to 2003 with the Detroit 60 series engine in it. And for me, so far, it hasn't been really easy to find. I got a couple guys that are looking for me. I live in El Paso, Texas, so I decided to go over to the Mesilla Valley. What is the international dealer? They
okay.
had any older trucks, at least maybe a 2007, you know, before the DPF and the way they're specced out and everything, you know, figured maybe I could find me a decent truck there. And they didn't have any older ones, so they started talking to me about the 2010. It's got the ISX in it, of course, but it's, you know, it's got all the specs, of course. It's got the tag axles, you know, the right rear ends. It's got the super singles and the display on the dash, which I know isn't always right. It's showing 9.3 miles per gallon. So I started doing some math. I said, well, even if I had some costs due to the ISX and the DPF, maybe that would offset. I drive 200,000 miles a year. So I know when you talk about savings, it might even more because of how many miles I drive. So I already know probably the answer to my question, but is it a bad move to go that way? I have all the records also. They sent me maintenance records, even the general inspections when it goes to the lane. It's got 750,000 miles on it. At 690,000 miles, the DPF was replaced, the dozer, the turbo. So something happened, but everything's, about 50, 60,000 miles old right now.
Yeah, and the fact that it happened at, 700,000 is a good sign, that it was doing well, and now you've got a new DPF. Here's the thing. If that thing gets the fuel mileage we expect, it would be worth owning. Hands down. Mm-hmm. I mean, fuel mileage is everything. If we can get 8+, almost 9 miles to the gallon, we know that might not be totally accurate, but it's a good sign that obviously this truck does really well. We know that Mesilla Valley specs these things from front to back for good fuel economy. I'm good with all those things. There's always that risk that this thing goes sideways on us and starts getting 6 miles to the gallon and nobody knows why. And that's always my fear with the newer trucks, that they're just not predictable and they're not consistent. So, if we have an 03 or older, we can make some pretty solid predictions about cost. I mean, we know what it's going to cost to put fuel in it. We know what it's going to cost to maintain it. And those numbers will be very consistent. There are very few things that can happen to an older truck that will screw up my numbers. The new trucks, it's a risk. You have to decide whether or not you're willing to take that risk.
Right. The toughest problem I'm having with finding the older truck is, I found some Volvos 2001 to 2003 with the ISX in Salt Lake City. He didn't have any Detroits. And so I started asking questions, and he says, come on out to Salt Lake City. I'm sure you'll find ones you like, and you'll drive it home. I really don't want to hear that, but it's hard to ask for records and things like that when you're dealing with those that year truck.
Well, it's not hard at all. First of all, you pull a rig dig report. You call them up and say, I want a full ECM done and any history. They may or may not have history. An ECM, if they tell you they can't do an ECM, you just hang up the phone and move on, because we can always do an ECM. Some dealers don't want to. They're lazy. Who knows why? But if a dealer tells me they can't, or they try to, hem and haw their way around it, I just hang up the phone and move on. The older trucks are out there, and I wouldn't settle for an ISX. I mean, if I were buying now if you want anything newer than an 01, you're going to have to settle for some other engine. The Volvos stopped putting Detroits in it in 01, so you've got to look at, in my favorite years are 99 through 01, that model with a Detroit. They're out there. I bet I've reviewed 4 of them this week for people. I just had a call last night on the show last night. $15,000 had a new crate engine in it.
Yeah, I heard that.
That'd
be outstanding. I wish I could find that.
Yeah.
I've heard in the past, is it the trucker paper? I mean, is that where you're looking and just doing an advanced search?
I do a lot of things. Truck paper is primary. I mean, I will literally search truck paper multiple times a day. When I'm looking for used trucks, I will search truck paper multiple times a day, day after day after day. And I've taken as long as 2 months to find the right used truck. But I will also go out and I'll work directly with dealers, and I'll give them a list of exactly what I'm looking for. I want a 99 through 2001 Volvo with a Series 60, a 13-speed. I don't really care about the rear ends or the tires. And I'll give them a rough budget. And I'll say, look, when you find this truck, call me. And I'll have 10 dealers looking for trucks for me at the same time.
That's what I've done. I've got a couple dealers looking. I need to get more looking.
You'll find it. I keep looking. You'll find it. And again, the Mesilla Valley trucks, if I were going to buy a truck in that year, in Mesilla Valley certainly specs them well. I mean, you know you're getting good fuel mileage specs when you get their trucks. I know somebody that bought three or four of them, and had he not been able to DEGR them all, he said they would have put him out of business.
Wow.
He said he had nothing but problems. Now, that doesn't always happen, but he said he had nothing but problems with his. Fuel mileage was horrible. Maintenance costs were killing him. And luckily, he was still able to find somebody that got rid of all the junk. That's getting harder and harder to do. I would keep looking for that older truck. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. Kevin Rothman. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. We're going to head off this time to Pennsylvania. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Kevin? I got a question.
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I got a question on your categories in profit gauges and transferring over the Schedule C. You know, some are obvious, you know, what do you call it, which line they go to, but there's, you know, some of the ones that are left, you have to group together. My question is, how do you group them so you don't attract the attention of the IRS?
I wouldn't worry too much about it because most of the stuff we're talking about now is going to be smaller, miscellaneous kind of stuff. And it's all deductible, and it's all deductible at the same rate. So the IRS really can't say anything about where you put stuff. Because it doesn't change the tax. I mean, technically, if we could take all of our expenses, everything, and lump it into one category and say expenses. Now, I'm not recommending you do this. The IRS wouldn't like it. You would probably get audited. But when the audit was over, if your numbers were correct, there's nothing they can do. I can put it on any line I want. As long as it doesn't change the amount of tax I owe, there's no way they can penalize me. So I wouldn't get too hung up on it. Just, you know, we give a list. If you're in profit gauges, have you ever looked at the cheat sheet?
Yes, I have.
That kind of gives you an idea of where everything should go in what category.
Okay. See, because I was looking at their repairs and maintenance. And then, you know, if you sort of like read into TurboTax, it's sort of supposed to be repairs and maintenance for a building, you know, like painting, spackling.
Yeah, we put all that stuff under maintenance. But again, I wouldn't get too hung up on it. If you have a question, look at our cheat sheet. If it's on the cheat sheet, just use what the category we recommended. And if it's not on there, just use common sense and logic. Put it where it kind of fits, but it's not ever going to matter, really.
Okay, can you put it, you know, like, truck and car expenses, what do you call, what would you just put fuel there or just put fuel and weight tickets?
I put nothing there. I put nothing under car and truck expense on the Schedule C. What I do is I use the categories on the first page that they give us, like maintenance, you know, insurance, taxes.
Yeah.
Those are all on there. Things that aren't on there, there is no line on a Schedule C for fuel. But on the second page, they give us the blank lines and allow us to put in what we want. Now, fuel is such a big expense that I always put it on its own line and call it fuel. Tolls, scales, those kind of things, those are all second page lines that we add.
Okay, so that's like on line 30, right?
Boy, I'd have to go look. It might be. It's where they give us the blank lines and we can fill in our own categories.
Okay. All right. Oh, and, you know, talking, you know, like I've had a generator on my truck for years. And I did overkill. I got a 10K generator. You know, I've used my generator when the power went out in my house. But I got a four-cylinder Kubota, and I've thought about trying, you know, the batteries and stuff. I got a friend that's in the RV business, and one of the things that he stresses the most, you know, when people come in for repairs, talking about roof mounts that are 110, is with the repair, he always gives them a voltmeter, meaning what he call it, to be able to read what they're getting, whether it's their generator or whether it's shore power. And he feels that you have to get at least 110, and he says what he call it, at 105, he would unplug the rooftop, otherwise you're going to burn out the motor. And I think with one of those inverters, I think if you put one of those voltmeters and you watch it and make sure that you don't get below that 105, I think you'll be okay. I guess, you know, he came up with that. I guess when you go to an RV park, I never have, that sometimes the volts drop down to 90, you know, especially like when RV parks are out, you know, in farmland and stuff, and I guess during the mornings, the farmers milk and stuff, so the voltage drops down quite a bit, and that's supposed to be the hardest thing on the motor is the voltage drop. So I figure I'd pass that on, just something to keep in mind.
Now that's absolutely correct, and I deal with it all the time in the RV, and it's not just air conditioners that it affects. You drop voltage or over voltage, either one. And some RV parks are notorious for voltage levels all over the board, either too low or too high, and you can wipe out all kinds of components. I mean, a lot of RVers carry voltage regulators, big voltage regulators that they plug in before they plug into the power source just for that reason. So, yeah, you've got a great point. This goes along with the point that I made earlier about, you know, when we start cobbling together batteries, inverters, generators, and AC units, and we're all using different pieces and parts, the results are going to be all over the board. And that's why one of my projects is to come up with a system that I can say, here's the components and here's how it's going to perform. Let's go to Alabama. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Well, as usual, my luck, as soon as I get able to talk to you, I lose signal. But
right.
My question is, my company gets a discount at Pilot Lange where we get fuel. And we don't know that exact discount. I'm sure there's a lot of people that are the same way. But am I able to go back in the profit gauges and edit the price I pay for fuel?
Yes, easily.
Yes.
Now, let me give you
all
a couple different scenarios, because everybody handles this a little different. We have the ability to either separate fuel gauges and profit gauges for your account. Each individual user has that ability to either use them as two separate systems or to use them together. They sync up and you only have to enter your fuel receipts once. Now, if you want them to sync up, that means that when you get your discount, you are going to have to go back and edit every fuel entry, but it's pretty simple. I mean, it's a couple clicks, you change the amount, save it, and you're done. So it's not that hard. Or some people say, well, you know what, instead of me going back and changing my fuel discounts all the time, they just unsync the two programs. So they put their fuel tickets into fuel gauges, and they don't really worry about the price because they're not using that part for accounting. Then when they enter their settlements into profit gauges, they just enter their fuel cost, which gives them all the discounts. So those are the two different ways you can think about doing it.
All right. Well, I'm not on profit gauges yet. I'm on fuel gauges, but not profit gauges. I'm getting ready to buy this truck tomorrow.
Okay.
It's a lease purchase kind of deal, but it's pretty much set up as a personal one.
Well, when you're setting up profit gauges, there will be a section in there where you can choose to sync the two programs, and that's what you want to think about. If you sync them, you won't have to enter your fuel receipts twice. They'll already be there, but the number will be incorrect, and you'll have to go back and adjust each one. Like I say, it doesn't take that long, or you can just leave them separate. Enter your fuel tickets just to track your fuel mileage, and then use your settlements for your fuel cost. Either one works just fine.
All right. And next question is, this is a 2003 79. It's got a 12.7 in it. It's got a 10-speed with 355 rear end. I'm getting low sixes if I'm good on it. I don't know, I run about 67 or so. I can get, if I keep it slow, I can get, you know, mid six, almost high. Do you, how much do you think I can improve that with tires and everything else?
You know, we have people who are well up into the high sevens on classics. Eight isn't out of the question. Now, to get eight out of a classic, you're going to have to do a lot of work. You're going to have to drive it about 55 to 57. But it can be done, and you've got all the right stuff. I mean, sure, the aerodynamics aren't any good, but you've got the right engine. The 10-speed's okay. We can live with that. 355s are okay. But if we did enough modifications and you drove this right, 7.5 to 8 is possible. Stick around. We'll be right back here on the Road Dog Sirius XM 128. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We are off to Texas this time. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Good afternoon.
What's on your mind today?
Not much. I have a quick comment about the guy. If you remember correctly, you got me in contact with the other gentleman that had the three or more trucks from the Mesilla Valley, and I went through the whole process with them. And in reality, you know, those trucks get 6.2 to 6.5 unless you drive them 65 to 70. And if you remember correctly, they tried to charge me $1,500 for doing ECMs because I ended up not buying a truck from them because they were crap. So that should make it real easy for them. Schneider. The Schneider trucks are way better, more used. The used trucks for Schneider are much more better for fuel efficiency than those Mesilla Valleys are, actually. But I wanted you to take a look at the fuel gauges. I've had my Super Singles on the truck and the trailer for, I don't know, almost, I think I only did one run with this truck, and then I put them on there. And I've literally been between 6 and 7 the whole entire time because of the route that I run and the wind that I'm in constantly.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at it now. You know, the good news is that your numbers are pretty consistent. I mean, you're not all over the board. You know, you're low on, let me look at a 90-day. Your low on your 90-day is 5.95. We might as well call that 6. And your
right.
high is 7.4. I mean,
right.
you're less than a mile and a half per gallon swing, and your average is 6.7 on a 90-day.
Right.
So it's consistent.
All I've done is switch everything over to Super Singles. I haven't even I have a schedule to go put the Fast system on and the Echo Pure. So I figured after I do those two things, I'll be real close to the 8 mark.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good start. I mean, and like I say, I love it when I see a truck that's so consistent, because when we see trucks with, you know, it's not unusual for me to look up trucks and find a 2.5 mile per gallon swing. In the wintertime, I've even seen 3 mile per gallon swings. Now, when you're dealing with a truck that's so inconsistent, it's much more difficult to really pin things down and track all your improvements. Yours should be pretty easy to track the improvements because it is pretty consistent.
Yeah, and I do the same amount of miles every month.
Yeah.
And I just give you an update real quick on the tire monitoring system on that TSD.
Yeah.
The way that they recommend hooking it up is to the starter, and I didn't know anything about how to pull apart the starter and hook it up to it, so I just hot-wired. I don't want to call it hot-wired, but I have a 400-watt inverter that I sit like a Cobra that I plug into my cigarette lighter, and it sits on top of my dash, and I just wired it to the back of that because it's always on, and it's always plugged in. It might not be on, but the power is always running to it. So it actually never turns off. Like when they recommend, you know, when you turn the truck off, you know, that thing will turn off and then turn back on when it comes on. I just leave it on all the time. And, you know, I've had very little issues. And any time I have, I get an answer or a problem solved pretty quick. And the other day, I was just at a rest area about 2:30 in the morning, and the alarm went off on me. And it basically, you know, woke me up and told me that my tire pressure dropped about 20 pounds and there was a problem. And, I was able to fix it before I even got out of the rest area. And, you know, running with Super Singles and everything, I obviously have a spare, and I won't run without one. And, you know, so this thing let me know exactly, you know, what was going on and everything. And able to avoid having to get a blowout. And spend $1,500 on a tire and a rim.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. I started testing tire monitoring systems several years ago. And the thing is that not only did I want to test them short-term to make sure they work, but we also like to test things long-term, meaning a year or more, to make sure they last, and then to find out about customer service over time. And we tested 3 different systems for tire pressure. They all worked okay in the beginning, but then we started seeing problems with them, sensors failing and sensors leaking, and customer service just wasn't all that great. I mean, I wasn't finding anything I was very impressed with. So
right.
A little over a year ago, we started testing the TST system, and Jeff Zarley put it on his truck, tested it for a year. The company has been fantastic with us. Now, they do know who we are, so sometimes we try to test things anonymously so that we don't get any special treatment. And
right.
we did for a little while, but then the company knew we were testing it, so they're on top of it, and our customer service has been top-notch. But I'm also hearing from a lot of other people, yourself and others, who said their customer service is great. Interestingly, Mike Beckett from MD Alignment just came out today, I think, or I saw it today, that TST is the tire monitoring system that he recommends and now sells. and we're really, really close to picking this up as an endorsed product. Now, I need to go back to the company, see if they're interested in working with us. I think they are. They call us every week. But I've got it in my truck and trailer now. I've only had it in there for one trip, but I like it. So I think this is going to be the one.
I got to tell you, you know, I call him all the time when I have a problem with something, and he answers and solves it. But I actually called him, and I forget what day it is because I'm out here 9 days straight, and I don't remember Saturdays and Sundays. I called him at Sunday at 2 o'clock in the morning. Or I'm sorry, I called him Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. It rang at his office, and before I could hang up, he called my cell phone with his cell phone, asking me what I needed.
Wow. Yeah, I've been hearing more and more of that. So it looks to me like they have a good product. And here's the thing. I realize we are always going to deal with some sort of failure on a system like this. Those sensors take a beating. Sensors will fail. I'm okay with that. That's part of having one of these systems. All I want is I don't want them to fail all the time. And when they do, I want a company that will stand behind them and work with me, and they seem to be willing to do that.
I'll give you another quick update on that. The day that I got them, I thought I had a sensor that was bad, and before I got home, it was in the mail.
Yeah,
and
that's the kind of stuff we've been hearing.
Right, and I guess the one thing that I did have an issue with was I put the repeater. There's a repeater that goes with it so it can contact the monitor. I put it in the cab of my truck at first. That didn't work too well. So I actually took it to a friend of mine, and we rewired it, and I put it on the back of the chassis on the truck. And since I've done that, I've never had one of these sensors just blank out on me like it did before when it was in the front of my cab. And I haven't done it.
I've got the repeater back on the frame near the fifth wheel, and it seems to be working great. So we're not 100% yet, but we're very close. Probably right after the CMC, we will consider bringing that product on as an official partner because I think we finally found one after all this testing. So I'm pretty happy. And I was happy to see Mike Beckett pick it up as well. Let's go to... Let's go to North Carolina. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I was going to ask you about extended sleeper, but I'm just more concerned about the oil sample. I could do a oil sample and got a bypass filtration system from another resource that's got the long black tubes. And I got oil samples from them, but I don't ever hear too much on the oil samples with them. But I just want to get your opinion on these oil samples that I got. I don't have the current one, but I've got it up till January. I don't have the latest one, but I was going to see if you could look at those and tell me what you think
I've got pretty good history here, so I should be able to tell you what we've got going on. Now it's showing 1.3 million miles. Is that original on the engine, or has there been an in-frame?
That's an original on the engine, and right now it's a 1,386,000 as of right now.
Wow. That's excellent. That's outstanding. So not seeing anything jumping out right away. Viscosity looks a little higher. Are you using Lucas?
No.
Yeah, I wonder why the viscosity is so high. It's not horrible, but it's...
I don't know if it matters, but I do have a front engine cover leak, so I have to put oil quite often, maybe 2 or 3 gallons every other week in there. So I don't know if that
would... that shouldn't matter. I'm all out of time, but this sample looks good. I mean, I could go over details, but there's nothing in here you need to be concerned about. This is a great sample for a 1.3 million mile engine. This would be a good sample for a 300,000 mile engine. So just keep doing what you're doing. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. Stick around. Jonesy's up next. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. All right, everybody, thanks for joining me. We'll see you here tonight for the live show.